Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Mad Jin. With guest co-host...
Mega Bears fan.
Did everybody just disappear?
No. I was just...
I said that and it just went silent.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 175. I am the Mian Team, the host with the most irradiated land, and I am joined by regular co-host Dan Q.
It's another tour of the show. Hold on tight.
Makalua.
Is it nap time yet?
And Majin.
Definitely nap time.
And also joined by guest co-host Mega Bears fan.
Just another godless killing machine.
Yes.
Oh, you'll fit in right in with Phil then.
Was Civilization V the first game to come out of this new space?
Yeah, it was. It was indeed.
Hey guys, there's a video of the inside of Firaxis. It's neat. I want one of those slidey doors.
You mean the door that makes it feel like you're in a meat freezer?
It's a wooden door, though. It's not a meat freezer. A meat freezer door would have a lock.
Oh, I'm sorry. A medieval meat freezer.
Yeah, so this tour comes from Rev 3. They have a tour of the Firaxis studio where they've been for the past 3.5 years. The CEO of Firaxis, Steve Martin, takes them on a tour. And with regards to the doors, there was some similar comments in the YouTube comments. For instance, making references to feeling like a jail cell.
You'll see kind of the initial layout of what we did to figure out how our space was going to be organized to help support collaboration, community, kind of working together, having some privacy, but some community as well. So, like, we got these big, cool doors, right? And this group can close this door, and they're private. They can open this door, and now they're part of the world.
The idea being that in their single-floor office, you can go to one section of the office, and all of these people are working on a like project, and all these other people are working on a like project. And they consulted someone to help them design their space.
Space Planner really helped us meet with groups and say, how do you work? You know, how often do you use a big area? How often do you use a small area? How often do you not want to talk to anybody else? How often do you want to be alone?
Yeah.
And they helped us understand what the significance of each group was in terms of space. It was fascinating. I loved it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's nice that the door doesn't swing out into the hallway and, you know, smack people in the face. So, I mean, yeah, that's an improvement because I've been in several jobs where, you know, you have to have doors with windows on them and signs on them, you know, telling you to open the door slowly so that you don't hit somebody and make them burn themselves with hot coffee as they're walking back and forth to the break room.
No, use of space is always good. I mean, I've worked in places where they had a big floor, but they put up 6-foot dividers all over the place. So it's like, don't worry, you can work together. Just lean over the divider.
A nice little cubicle farm.
Yeah, let me stand up, interrupt what I'm doing, lean over, go, hey.
Yeah.
I do agree with the comment with regards to there being like no outside windows to most of the offices. But to me, that doesn't make the office bad, especially since the idea is that you're not going to be spending all of your day inside your office anyway.
Well, offices should really just be for, like, people who need absolute quiet. So, like, the audio department should have their own rooms so they can do absolute quiet stuff. And management tends to need closed doors once in a while.
Plot but, against you.
Yeah, but the dev team itself should generally not be behind closed doors. It ruins productivity to have people locked away.
Yeah. Overall, it looks like a pretty nice facility. I mean, they got their own little gym in there.
This is our mind and body thing, you know, important for the body as much as the mind. We get together as a group, we'll do yoga in here, we'll lay out the mats, have an instructor in and do our thing, right?
I have to say, now that I think about it, since I've been here, seeing a lot of the staff, this is one of the more fit group of game developers.
That's awesome. I take that, we have a basketball court out back, volleyball, we even have a tee box.
The thing that was really interested me the most, though, was I actually looked up the address on Google Maps, And assuming that I got the right address, because sometimes Google Maps screws things up horribly, it's this little area off in like the middle of nowhere, way outside the city, where there's like three or four little office buildings, and then a little planned community of houses right across the highway from the mall. So it almost seems like somebody went out and just built some office buildings and then houses for all the people who work there to live at, so that all they have to do is just cross the street and everybody's neighbors. So it was just kind of weird seeing that.
It would be quite possible that some of the Phyraxians actually live in those houses, although the comment was made that our employees spend a lot of time in the office, so families are often brought to the studio as well. So it's like, let's go see Mommy and Daddy because they're stuck at the office. But
we haven't seen you in months.
They also talked about the fun zone where they gather as a studio where there are traditional games. I saw a ping pong table, saw a pool table. They play board games, and they also play games from other companies because they recognize there is value in games other than the ones that they develop.
No, that makes them revolutionary thinkers right there.
That is traitorous.
Heathen.
I found that the person who did the tour from Rev 3, Adam Sesler, as well as Steve Martin, did not only a good job of showing the space, but also making me feel like I wanted to continue to watch. And there's actually some unexpected humor. I really didn't expect the CEO of Phyraxis or otherwise to make a joke with information that he volunteered.
We do art stuff, too. We'll have traditional art classes going.
Oh, wow.
So we'll have a model come in, sometimes clothed, and they'll do their thing. But traditional art skills.
Well, civilization,
important.
You know, you have to understand artistic styles.
Of,
yeah.
That's right, what they wore and what they didn't.
Yeah.
I'm like, wait. I could see the delayed reaction from Adam from Rev 3 as his brain processed what it was.
Wait a minute.
A CEO made a joke?
No. Trying to remember whether his show was PG or PG-13. What am I allowed to say in response to that?
Felt like we got a decent tour of the space. They explained what the space was for. We got to see what it was they were talking about. And then the banter between the two, even though the video post-produced was less than 8 minutes. The only thing I felt like was, could we see more? And could we actually talk to some more people? Because occasionally you would see someone in the background for like half a second. Hey, who's that guy? What's he doing? Why don't you go and say hello? But, oh.
That guy's the janitor.
Sorry, he's in the process of disrobing so he can model for the artists. Moving on now.
He's putting on the motion capture suit, guys.
There was a comment in the YouTube stream from Quag TS, this is his username. I used to work in the same building as these guys in Hunt Valley back in 2008. You could always tell who worked at Phyraxis because while everyone else was decked in suits and business casual, you'd see people wearing jeans with their arms full of consoles and wires in the elevator. I asked one of them about E3 once. They offered me a tour, but they moved to another building before I got around to taking them up on that offer. This video feels like closure on my missed opportunity. And as for the old Phyraxis studio, I don't know why the current owners and administrators of Apollon Civilization site took it offline, but I and the person that I co-founded Apollon with, Marco Cianopoulos, we actually got a tour of Phyraxis. My gosh, that was 7 years ago now, in their old office where they were spread across three floors and their office was like this column. So the office wasn't very wide, but it was very tall and you'd go up these stairs. I mean, the office was nice, but of course it felt very compartmentalized as a result. So when they decided to get their own space, which I expect in the other building they were leasing, they probably actually, you know, they own this space since they got someone to come in and design for them. Let's do this kind of from the ground up. How is it that we want to be able to work, and what is it that we want to see? I guess after the video, if you're thinking you want more, Curbs69 in the comments said, confirmed, next Battlefield map pack will include Phyraxis office, only $9.99.
There you go. You can set up a protest at the Phyraxis office. They're quite glad to come out with a barbecue.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned protest, because there was some visceral from Darkstar8473. This is what blows my mind. Do you see the luxury these developers work in? And these greedy effers want more and more money from us. The studio looks better and costs more than half of the individuals you sell your game to. Maybe if you had a modest studio but no fine leather and posh fabrics around, could only imagine what those aristocrats at Electronic Arts and Activision are basking in.
Well, maybe if they didn't have the nice things, they'd be making crappy games. Did you guys think of that?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's you reap what you sow, and if you put someone in a dingy space in a cubicle farm, I think
you're going to get crap. Or excited.
Yeah. And besides, what's wrong with a company making money off something they build? Seriously,
well, no, they can't possibly do that. They should be doing it for the love of the fans.
Yeah, well, are the fans feeding them? Are the fans going to house them? Are the fans going to do everything? No, no, shut up and let people make money off things that they build.
You know, there are probably some people out there that would feed and shelter them.
Yeah, there is.
I know that's besides the point. But
it is besides the point, but I think there would be. I agree. All right, we're going to put up a Kickstarter fund to house and feed some Firaxis employees. That way we can move them into a dingy place to work.
Basement or attic.
Basement, man.
If you're making a troll mechanic, you have to be in the basement. But other than that, it's a choice.
Yeah.
XXX Burke says, I think Sid sleeps with the book How to Win Friends and Influence People under his pillow. Well, it wasn't just Sid that made these design decisions. Come on, we can give Sid a lot of credit, but it wasn't just Sid that designed this space.
Oh, probably had nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
I didn't actually watch the entire tour. Was Sid actually in the video?
Briefly in the background, yes. We got to see his office and see him working in his office. Although we couldn't see what was on his monitor, so, you know, who knows what he was actually looking at.
with quotation marks.
I'll throw out maybe a certain tablet-based air game.
Oh, would this be something to do with World War I and combat and its turn-based?
Yeah, probably that one.
Developing for iOS was an approach that was a lot like the first time we developed for console. What are the constraints? How do we make the best game for this platform? What are the usage patterns? What are the kinds of people that are going to play? What are some new people we could get to play? And that's kind of where we started.
The second Rev3 video that they published on the same day, and also this one hosted by the same person from Rev3, Adam Sessler. In this video, Sid Meier actually speaks. Jake Solomon, the lead designer on XCOM Enemy Unknown, and the co-lead designers on Haunted Hollow, one of the two mobile platform titles that Firaxis is kind of their debut into the market, along with Ace Patrol that Imagine referred to a little earlier. And essentially, it's explaining why the studio is embracing mobile, but I think something that's important to keep in mind is that embracing mobile is not mutually exclusive to continuing to develop for the PC. Got that? When Firaxis developing Civilization Revolution for the consoles, you're abandoning PC, you bastards. Suddenly, that was the jerk reaction. And now we're developing mobiles. You're abandoning the PC, you bastards. And I'm just like, oh my goodness.
Because guys, I totally can't have more than one team working on one thing at one time.
Yeah, just as long as they don't think that this is peanut butter and chocolate, because if they do start to get tablet in my PC, I am going to be very upset.
Well, you can put your tablet in your PC. It just probably won't work very well after the fact.
Just open up your case and set it in there. You're good.
There you go.
Now, why would Firaxis want to embrace mobile? Why would you want to embrace a new gaming platform where you're capturing more people more of the time, or even people you wouldn't capture on PC gaming because they're gaming on the go? Might that have also something to do with money? Because if they're able to make more money, then that money can be put back into the company to develop not just more for the mobile platform, but also for the PC platform. Because something that was talked about is that the mobile platform gives Firaxis this testing ground.
Yes, we're able to experiment with ideas that might not get greenlit for a full-blown PC game, but we can experiment with them on the mobile platform. And again, as designers, we enjoy that freedom, and that's part of the fun of making mobile games, is experimenting and innovating and trying new things.
You don't have the demands that you must have shiny this and shiny that. It must look as polished as the gameplay is, so they can actually spend more money proportionately on gameplay and still spend less money overall. And then if it works well on the mobile platform, then there's more of an impetus to then go back to the publisher, in this case 2K, which owns Firaxis, and say, hey, this worked well on the mobile platform. Is there a way that we can now translate that to the PC platform? Will you greenlight that effort? Just like Firaxis is now trying to find a way to add to the existing game options that you get on the mobile platform. because it's, oh, well, it's a mobile platform, so therefore Angry Birds and their clones are the only games that are going to work. Well, that's kind of all we've seen so far, kind of like on the console. Before there was Civilization Revolution, a lot of people said, no, can't be done. Is it going to look the same? Is it going to interact the same?
I mean, that's the thing. That's bullshit. I would almost say 90% of the turn-based games back in the 90s were on console. And all of the games everybody ever loved for turn-based strategy back in the 90s were on console.
No way.
Console and turn-based strategy is not mutually exclusive.
I will concede the point that there were some, quite a okay, few maybe good not turn-based 90%. Games on console, but...
Maybe not 90%.
In the 90s, there were a lot of good TVS on PC, and yeah, there were some of the better ones, in my opinion.
Yeah, I know. There was a lot, but also considering that there was more consoles back then, too.
Well, and a lot of the PC games at that time were being ported to consoles, even
turned
the other way games.
Yeah, that did happen a fair amount.
I'm pretty sure that Civ 2 was on the PlayStation, and I don't know if Civ 1 was on a console.
Yeah, Civ 2 on the PlayStation, that was an example of how not to port a title,
that's
though.
True.
Yeah, I never played it, so...
Yeah, that is true. But there were some pretty awesome ones back then, too, that were console-based only, mostly because a certain console had a CD player well before everybody else. It was crazy.
Yes.
Yeah, I know. I actually got my introduction to simulation-style games through the PlayStation 1 version of SimCity 2000, which, still to this day remains one of my favorite games ever.
That game is so broken. Fun, but broken.
Yeah. Fun, not balance.
I think it really takes software, good software, to change how people use the device. I mean, people didn't play games on their computers until there were good games that they could sit. I mean, you wouldn't really think... You'd sit in a computer for two or three hours at a time in an uncomfortable chair, not on your couch, That takes a good piece of software to compel me to do that. So I think there's some preconceived notions about the platform that we want to challenge.
But the mobile platform is just going to have smaller amount of space. Like, they can't build a massive game on it. Same for consoles. You can't build a massive game on it. So it has to be smaller. It has to be more direct. But as somebody already posted on the YouTube sub, considering a lot of turn-based strategies can be played just with a mouse, you can actually adjust it so that it'll work on mobile or console fairly easily, control-wise.
And not just interface-wise, but the type of game as well. Turn-based strategy works well on a mobile platform. I'm not certain I'd like to play Halo on my phone, though.
Yeah. Well, no, people can.
Just because you can doesn't mean that you either should or would actually like to do that. It's nice to be able to, I can only play a few turns for a few minutes while I'm sitting here waiting to board my plane or get on the train or something like that.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, you could also be at your home in front of your computer and playing for an hour or two, or even on a tablet. Oh, I don't want to have to sit at my desk. I like to be able to lounge on my couch. Oh, look at that. Turn-based strategy translates well to those different environments, as well as, different styles of play.
Although I got to point out that there is actually a ton of games that are not Angry Birds on tablets and cell phones. Like, my iPhone has Settlers and Archon.
I have a version of Free Civ on my phone.
There's quite a few successful games on those, actually.
Yep.
And there's even Minecraft strategy-ish. Pocket Edition.
No! Stop talking about that.
I just want to say
something like that.
Fine, let's talk about Minecraft on the Xbox then.
Yeah, no.
Why couldn't they just port the PC and even make it compatible?
I just want to say that the idea of a really good Civilization-style game on mobile kind of scares me, because the idea of starting a game while I'm in the bathroom just terrifies me. I don't want that to start.
Just one more turn. Oh, wait, I have to go. Oh, well, more turns.
Jason, do you own a Nintendo DS?
What are you doing in there? The cramps.
I have a portable console since Sega Game Gear.
Oh, okay, because the thing is, you can do that now, get a Nintendo DS and, go into the bathroom, and that's just,
Yeah, I've avoided that.
It actually reminds me of a past regular co-host on Polycast, Carta Mandua, Annalie Barney. I remember her saying, I'm not that desperate for one more turn, and I think that's to each their own, right?
Yeah, and I got to randomly say that there is a version of Civ 5 out there on mobile already. Just randomly got to say that.
Some people are just saying, oh, this isn't going to sell, this isn't going to sell, this isn't going to sell. People said that about Civilization Revolution, and there's been what, at least according to VGCharts.com, since its release in 2008, almost 2 million have been sold that can be accounted for. So that's like 360,000 a year, which according to their numbers for Civ 5, that's about 30% less. So if, and I'm kind of extending this here with a little bit of bullcrapology, but you know.
Yay, bullcrapology!
If what is sold for consoles, let's just say it's going to be 30% less on the mobile platform, whatever the mobile platform happens to be, iOS, Android, whatever, just mobile in general, that would be about 256,000 sales. The price point for Civ Rev on the iPhone, iPod Touch, and iPad was like $3 like it is right now, then like that would be almost $1 million. Think also that not only would it be that money, but you wouldn't have likely invested as much money up front as well. So the return on investment proportionately is also higher. So it can be win-win for people looking to make money and people wanting to game. Oh, do you have to go on a business trip? You can't be playing Civilization V in front of your PC. You don't have an iPad. You haven't bought that yet, so you can't play Civilization V and with Windows 8 and the touch. Do you have a cell phone? Well, guess what? Do we have something for you?
Yes, because the thing that your boss really wants you to do on that business trip is to walk up to the business partner with your right hand extended to shake hands and your left hand on the phone going, hold on. I gotta nuke Montezuma.
Hey, you might get cause some favorable reactions that way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who has played against Montezuma would not like nuking that guy.
Hey, now just a second, Jason. That person you're meeting might think, wow, this guy can multitask.
Yeah.
I want to work with him. Yeah. How do you know how people are going to react?
Hey, just don't. Completely unpredictable.
Why you look at glass half empty and not half full, sir? Why?
Why you know half full?
I actually look at the glass as being twice as tall as it needs to be.
What game means to us is something that you can keep playing and get deeper and deeper into and replay and things go differently. So that's fundamental to our understanding of what games are. We can do just about the same amount of that in a mobile game or in a console game that we do in a PC game.
For one thing, India has always been kind of a pet peeve for me, just because, like, the name of the bonus is population growth, but the bonus isn't actually towards the growth of population. So I kind of think that maybe India should just get faster growth so that they actually get to use that bonus instead of just being punished for doing what you're supposed to be doing to play the game, which is build more cities. Even if you just start with like a percentage modifier or maybe even just like plus one food per city, it would make their ability a little bit more of a reward because you're actually going to have cities that are going to grow faster. So the extra happiness becomes more important to have.
So that's the thing. Many people read the unique ability and just think it's a negative and they completely misunderstand what it is. I would agree that a potential growth bonus would be nice, but then again, just go tradition and you already get it twice. The thing is, Indies UA, you get half the unhappiness per pop, which is the vast majority of the happiness being used up on a city. So you get half of that already. So, you know, one Colosseum takes care of four pop, which makes the point about when people say Colosseums are too expensive for what you get, they usually are, except for India, they're not. Yes, it's six unhappiness, or basically doubled, per city, but India, and I've complained about this many times, does not follow the rules when it comes to local happiness getting converted to global happiness. Basically, every other civ's stuck with getting capped for local to global happiness, except for India. India has special rules inside the game that allows them to convert, I think it's 0.67 as a multiplier, local happiness to global happiness. So that six unhappiness will eventually get wiped out purely by local happiness so that the city itself is not getting trashed. Will still allow you to expand. I think there's just a bunch of people who don't understand everything around that unique ability. That's usually where the problem comes from. Because if you don't understand that they can convert local to global happiness to get rid of that extra unhappiness, then sure, if you look at it, ooh, I can't expand, but they're meant to go tall.
Yeah. Another thing, I think I had done the math at one point, and basically the ability becomes happiness neutral. The double unhappiness from the city is completely offset by the half happiness from population. Once they started patching the game after the initial release, to increase the growth rate of cities, the ability didn't suck as much.
I think last time I checked, it was at plus 12 local happiness that let you basically have the whole city for free. But that was before the last G&K change, I think. The whole Mughal fort thing, that could be something to buff them up. Fix that.
America's Manifest Destiny ability. I don't know how often that ability actually gets used. I, for one, never really use it to buy tiles.
It's a solid, unique ability. Very, very solid. The plus one sight's perfect for all game. There's never a point in the game where plus one sight is a bad thing.
Yeah, no.
Especially when your catapults and other range siege units can see as far as they can shoot. And therefore, that makes them way better than everybody else's. Because if you lose that melee unit up front near the city, it's okay. You can still keep attacking the city
right.
with your siege units. People are going to start realizing, probably with Brave New World, that the tile buying has gotten a boost due to less gold on the map. And therefore, control of tiles and cheaper cost to buy tiles is going to make it a lot more powerful. Hmm. So I think it's already getting a boost in a roundabout way.
I didn't think buying tiles was that common, but...
It's usually not that common for any civ outside of America because, well, it's usually expensive.
Yeah.
And I think with Gods and Kings, the costs got adjusted, so it wasn't as bad. But America always got the cheaper costs, and whenever America can buy two tiles for the price of everybody else buying one, that's really good.
I agree. I just don't know how many tiles would be worth buying typically. So how many times are you going to use this ability in a game? You might use it like maybe 5 or 6 times across 4 cities. That would be a lot, actually.
Yeah, usually the only time that I buy tiles is when I'm going for one of the natural wonders that, you know, I'd have like 2 or 3 tiles away from my city that the game just will not annex through the natural culture growth. Or yeah. also if I want to build like Machu Picchu and the city just won't annex the mountain that I'm near. So I have to spend, what is it, like 75 gold on a standard game or something to buy that damn mountain. If you've got like Krakatoa, if you're actually close enough to be able to get Krakatoa into a city.
Well, first take a screenshot.
Yeah.
You have to prove it. Right.
I've had it happen a few times, but first you have to wait for the city to annex all of those stupid sea tiles that it doesn't put any priority on because, you know, unmodified sea tiles are garbage. But then Krakatoa is always at least 3 tiles away from the coast. So if you even have it in range, it's the last thing you're going to get, which really sucks because, you know, science boost would be really awesome to have early in the game.
When you buy a tile, it does not increase the culture cost of other tiles. And so therefore, if you happen to have some money and you plant a city, this is an extreme case, by the way. This is not something you would normally do. But if you buy all the tiles within 3 of the city, the very first tile that will be cultured, it will be one in the 4th ring and the 5th ring. So your culture tiles will still spread out. So if you want to claim a lot of land and therefore, and also, you know, basically prevent the AI from settling near you, your natural culture expansion will start as if it was down at the very first tile, but you'll get all of the 4th and 5th rings around you via natural culture.
How much would that cost?
Well, it depends how much hills or stuff like that is in there. Flatland stuff is always cheaper than hills. But if you buy up, say, all of the more expensive land tiles or even just all the cheap stuff, and there's another way to do it. If you buy all the flat land tiles near your city, then the culture borders have no choice but to choose the hills and stuff. And therefore, you can get all of those much faster than you would normally with culture. I mean, Angkor Wat also just cranks up the benefit to doing it, at least as the Americans anyways. I wouldn't normally go with any of that concept except as the Americans. But it is a different style that you wouldn't normally do with any other civ. And so I think that's why most people get complainty about it, because they don't stop and go, how will I play this civ differently? I know there are people who complain about it who actually know the game systems really well, but still complain about it for different reasons.
Well, I think one of the reasons that that happens is because unlike Civ 4, Civ 5 very much kind of shoehorns players into particular styles of play at the beginning of the game. Because I know every time I start a new game, I have almost the exact same build order in my cities. It's, you know, it's scout, you know, monument, worker, you know, or workboat, depending on if I'm on a coastal city, etc. So the beginning of the game always plays out pretty much almost no matter what civ I'm playing as. Whereas in Civ 4, you had the different root level techs that every Civ had a unique combination of. So each Civ started with some unique set of buildings and units and improvements that they could construct. So there was a little bit more variety in those first few turns because there were just different options available depending on what Civ you were. And Civ 5 just doesn't have that. So you end up kind of falling into a routine, or at least I do. You know, maybe I'm just crazy. I don't know.
I would say Civ 5 has it. It's just less emphasized because everyone starts with agriculture and they don't start with things other than agriculture that are critical to the opening turns. But like as Majin is pointing out here, unique abilities and some of your other early choices are pretty map dependent and can cause you to make different choices even if you're using the same Civ. It's just not as extreme.
Yeah, the only really significant difference that I ever have is, do I start on the coast or not?
Yeah, then maybe you need to broaden horizons. I don't know. I don't feel shoehorned. I mean, yes, there are certain strategies that have been made more powerful than others, possibly. Or at least other ones are a little worse than others. But there are options, and you can take them. And different civs have different feels to them. So you can't just take, you know, your old generic civ and do something special. Each of the civs have something that would make you want to go somewhere else. Like Iroquois, you're going to go ironworking very, very quickly. Why? Because you can get Mohawk warriors and go run people over.
Yeah, but that's not quite what I'm talking about. Because what I'm talking about is like those very first few turns, you know, basically exploring that warrior, building that first scout, getting it out onto the field. Those first like 20 to 50 turns where you just have the one city and all your...
That's what I'm talking about. I mean, if you're going out to 50 turns, you can get ironworkings within that 50 turns. That's a completely different strategy than going one city up to National College. That's a completely different strategy than going to composite bows. That's a completely different strategy than going to horseback riding or, you know, if you happen to be coastal, going up to optics. There are changes. And even for the first 10 turns, I know people who do double scout. I know people who will build worker first. I know people who will build monument first or some combination thereof of each of those because maybe the terrain around them means that they want that worker as fast as possible because they have to work the tiles for them to become useful, i.e. if you get a plane start and you want to go animal husbandry. And otherwise you have to farm up all those river tiles because, well, it sucks. Plains rivers suck, at least till civil service. So yeah, you want to work her out quickly. Or you double scout because you get extra bonuses, or you want to meet all those city states or whatever else you want to do. Even for tradition, I don't know why people would go monument first. I'd still go scout monument on a tradition start because you can get it done fast enough.
And with the scout, if you get that culture ancient ruin, you get your free social policy right there.
Or at least way faster. Getting 20 extra culture on turn 5 is way better than getting it on turn anything before tradition. Speaking about reactions, though, how does the AI evaluate you?
Ah, we're transitioning. Okay. All right. This is actually over on Reddit, and it's by...
People still use that?
Apparently so.
This editorial, brought to you by Imagine, does not necessarily reflect the reviews of the rest of the public.
Putmalk. Okay.
Putmalk.
Apologies if I did mispronounce it. Otherwise, I spent too long regardless. This is an article about AI opinions, what it is, and how it affects diplomacy. And I'll start with the conclusion because it's shorter. Basically, how does this affect UN voting? AI votes for whoever they had the highest opinion of. Therefore, you'll want to lower your score as much as possible if you're pursuing diplomatic victory. That is right, listeners. A negative score is a good thing when it comes to diplomacy because negative 50 means they're your ally.
Yeah, that's...
The diplomacy victory is really golf in disguise.
Yeah. Yes, well put.
Yeah, when he says lower your score, he doesn't mean your in-game score. He means your...
Yeah, we're about to get to that.
Opinion inside. But yes, for some strange reason, negative numbers means they like you. Positive numbers means they hate you. Completely confuses everything, but...
I actually bet that has to do with the fact that when the game was first launched, there were so many more ways to piss off the AIs than to make friends with the AIs that just had to be, like, the default positive value.
I don't think it matters, personally. All right, so there's 7 of these. There's ally, friend, favorable, neutral, competitor, enemy, and unforgivable.
Basically, negative 50 is ally, negative 30 is new friend. Between negative 10 and 10 is neutral, and then 10 to 30 competitor, 30 to 50 enemy, and then anything over 50 would make you unforgivable. And after you nuke them a bajillion times and kill everything on the map, that's probably where you'll be, and you'll like it. Anyway, yep. I'll go ahead and read down the list of things. It shouldn't take too long, I don't think. Of things that boost and piss off the AI, like make it like you and make it hate you.
And this isn't even the full list.
Well, I'll cover what's in the article then.
Okay.
Returning civilians is negative 20. Denouncing an enemy is negative 15. I'm assuming that's an enemy of the AI in question. Resurrecting that civ is a very huge negative 200. So, you know, you can get away with some stuff if you resurrect them. Liberating cities, 1 is negative 30, 2 is negative 50, 3 or more is negative 60. So that, I guess they did that to prevent abuses that you could execute in Civ 4 that most people don't know about. Continuing on, forgive spying, negative 10, share intrigue, negative 20. Adopt similar late game policy.
Got a negative 20 times the number of times you share it.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, negative 20 per.
There we go. Okay.
Yes.
It's the same
similar late game policies, negative 5 times late game policy era modifier. That's a little bit less clear to me. Declarations of friendship, negative 35. Mutual declarations of friendship is negative 15, but you only get that negative 15 once. Recent trades can maybe be from anywhere from negative 1 to negative 30, depending on how good the value is. And by that, I'm assuming it's how favorable the AI feels it is, but who knows. Fight mutual wars, negative 1 to negative 50, depending on how many units or cities you kill. Kill cities. Yes, sirree. Burn them to the ground. Give in to declaration of friendship help requests, negative 20. Pay tribute, negative 30. He has in parentheses, doubt you'll ever get asked this, but somehow I think the AI might ask it.
I've seen that enough times, no one exists.
Yeah. Not as spammed as Civ 4, thankfully.
Well, I'll just say a tip to minimize the likelihood you're going to see that. Don't start hoarding gold like the AI likes to.
Yeah. Adopt human religion, negative 5 times era emphasis religion. Adopt AI religion, negative 3 times era emphasis religion.
I actually enjoy that the adopting the human versus AI religion is a little different. If the AI adopts a human religion, then there's more benefit out of that than you adopting the AI religion.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Basically, if they adopt your religion, they like you. You had it. But if you pick up their religion, they're like, eh. Yeah. Like, eh, didn't really make it for you, but whatever. Oh,
there's a good reason for that, though. Like,
oh, yeah, there is a good reason, I'm sure.
And once again, I'm thinking back to the tendons, how this tended to go 100% of the time, just about in Civ 4, and balancing this a little differently makes it a little bit more useful. But also, just having religion is better than not having religion in Civ 5. Mm-hmm. And if you're adopting the AI religion, you're giving it some stuff, but actually, how would you weight that? Someone adopting a religion and then spreading it as worth more than getting a religion when you otherwise wouldn't, despite not founding it?
No, I would definitely weigh picking up somebody else's religion more than somebody spreading my religion, because I could always just do it myself. Or, you know, also keep in mind that some of the beliefs in the spread side of the religion give me bonuses if I go attack that person that I've spread my religion to.
No, that's not what I'm getting at. What I'm getting at is the difference between having a religion or not at all versus someone else having your religion. Which one of those two things is stronger?
Having a religion versus not at all.
There you go. Then benefits are benefits. That would make sense why the AI has this particular weighting.
Yeah, benefits are benefits. It also depends on the type of religion and stuff like that. But still, just getting good benefits is always better than not having any.
Yeah, but if the benefits of having someone else pick up your religion are greater than the benefits of having a religion versus no religion, then the weighting wouldn't make sense.
Yeah, there's just so much.
Too much theory here. Continuing on, how do you anger the AI? There are lots of ways you can do it, and some of them are fun. Denouncing it is 35. Denouncing a human, 35. Interesting. Denouncing a friend, 15. Land dispute, we covet your lands. There are 4 tiers of this. Fierce is 30, strong is 20, weak is 10, none is negative 6. Wonder dispute, same thing. Minor civ dispute.
Same thing.
That'll be the policy if there's 4 tiers again. Warmonger. Warmonger amount divided by 2. Okay, so it's warmonger amount. The article doesn't tell us.
How much they hate you for fighting and beating people up. It's a completely separate article.
Do they, like, give you a physical number in-game that just says warmonger, like, 220 or something?
Yeah, well, they don't tell you the number, but yes, eventually it is number-based.
for a usefulness perspective in the article, like, that doesn't mean a whole lot.
You would have to explain what the war bunker amount was.
Yeah, and maybe he just doesn't know that because maybe he's getting all of this out of, you know, XML files or Lua scripts or something, and he just didn't look up that definition.
Actually, someone asked in the comments on Reddit, I'm curious, you're parsing all this info thanks to your prolonged study of the source code with the SDK. It says, specific number values may change because I didn't look at the XML files which define them. I just trusted the comments in the code, which hopefully are accurate.
Thanks for bringing it up. A lot of these are accurate because they didn't really change it, but the XML is going to be far more accurate than comments in the code.
Tell them to stop settling or spying. That annoys them. Made demand of AI. That annoys them. Culture bombs. Religious conversions. Really?
Mm-hmm. Based on cities converted. They don't care if you convert one or two citizens in a city. They only care when you convert a city to your religion.
And I wonder if that includes converting the same city more than once.
Yeah. If they're fighting over it, possibly.
Well, that would make anyone mad. Converting it, they convert it back, and then you convert it again.
Well, I gotta do something with all those missionaries. I don't want them to just take up space on the map.
Yeah, sometimes it can be diminishing returns to get into a fight with an AI for a religious city conversion, although I still find it much worse with regards to a city-state. They really sink their teeth into a city-state, or not at all.
It would piss me off if a human did that, too, though.
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
You take your dispute outside of the game as well. I mean, really.
Yes, don't do that.
I don't know if that's feasible.
Yeah, I've actually had AIs do that to me in some games where I've had like back and forth like four or five times. They convert my city. I have to convert it back. It is thoroughly annoying.
And you can, of course, tell them, we want you to stop sending missionaries to us. And actually, that comes up with an aside, which is someone says, so does it even serve a purpose to tell the AI not to settle near you? And Pultmulk says that telling them to stop spying will force them to reassign their spies elsewhere. Telling them to stop settling will create a 6-hex buffer around your cities and tell the AI not to settle near them. Whether you think that range is too small or too big is besides the point. They do respect your wishes, but I would qualify that answer. They do not necessarily respect your wishes between now and the end of the game, though.
No, of course not.
So even if they tell you, like, screw you, we settle where we please, does they still apply that buffer?
No.
Okay, so it's just if they accept the request.
Yeah, if they agree with you that they won't settle near you, then they'll be okay.
It's kind of like if the AI tells you, hey, stop settling near us, and you say, okay, but then within a certain period of time you go ahead and do that, you get a negative modifier. Whereas if you respect that for X number of terms, I'm certain it scales with game speed, then the game will tell you, you have respected the wishes and you have not settled near them during this time. But then after that, you could go ahead and settle near them. And unless they object to that again, then you're not going to get that negative modifier because you respected it for the period of time that is, air quote, expected.
Yeah. Standard speed, it's 30 turns, I do believe.
Okay. Stealing text, breaking military promises, and ignoring military promises.
Yeah, no, ignoring military promise. Basically, if you agree to go to war with somebody for the let's do this in 10 turns thing, and they come to you and say, all right, it's your time, and you say, too bad, they get mad at you.
Do they get mad at you if you just refuse in the first place?
No.
Then what's the point of that mechanic?
Yeah, actually, does this have any reference to there's the one diplomatic option where they say, hey, do you want to go to war with somebody? And then you have the option to say, like, how dare you? Or, no, I'm sorry, that's just not in my best interests. Does the how dare you actually have any effect on the AI at all? Was that in this list?
I don't think that was in the list. And I'm not sure that it even does anything.
It's supposed to.
Yeah, I've never figured out what that option does.
I just refuse to use that button anyways.
Yeah, I never use it either because I never know what the heck it does.
Well, no, for me, it's more like if I press this button and it works, it just means that this AI will not like me because I basically told them that they're jerks. Or I can just go, sorry, not right now.
But then the other alternative might be maybe it actually does affect their decision on whether or not to go to war.
Yeah, that could be, but I don't really care if two AIs war. It's like, yeah, go for it. I'll be over here.
Well, sometimes I do, because if it's a very large AI going against a very weak AI that I'm not in a position to defend, I don't want that very large AI taking even more territory.
They'll just attack you then.
Yeah, I know. Eventually they'll just do it anyway, but
one thing you could do that use is like to deliberately piss an AI off without having any consequences on pissing other AI offs. So like then you can get it to declare war on you instead of declaring war on it, maybe.
Well, one of the things that I'd really like to see changed is with the denouncement rules. I would really like to see some sort of system put in place where the players and AIs have to give an actual reason for the denouncement, so that then the other AIs can say, okay, is that reason justified? And if the reason is justified, then they don't get mad at you for it. So if you have like a pact of protection for a city state and an AI just invades them and starts going, I invaded your little pet city state. What are you going to do about it? And then you denounce them. That should not make your allies get mad at you because you're denouncing civs who are total jerks. Won't have those situations where one of your friends just suddenly turns into a total jerk. And you denounce them, and then suddenly all of your friends hate you because you're a friend denouncer.
If somebody is attacking a city-state and you denounce them for that reason, any civ that has a very high flavor for city-states should not get mad at you for that denouncement.
Right, or also any other civ that is friendly with that city-state.
Yeah, or something along that line. One thing to adjust into this is that a number of these degrade over time. That was added in Gods and Kings. So even though it's like 20 here, eventually it'll degrade over time and not be as important to the AI.
Doesn't it decay comparably to, you know, you tick off a city state because you got a unit sitting in their land for so many turns and then you walk away and then it just slowly starts to recover?
Yeah, I would say similar, but the length of time it takes to decay is different over time. So it's not just like one turn gets 1 point of it decayed. Sometimes it'll take a lot longer.
Oh, well, certainly. I wouldn't actually want it to decay at the same rate as a city-state. After all, we're talking about proper civs now.
Yeah, exactly.
Air quote, proper.
Air quote, proper.
Oh, I have a trolling segue. There was a Brave New World question and answer session that actually answered questions.
Oh, and the first question Phil's going to love. The first one was, will there be any random events in Brave New World like in Civ 4? Well, sort of yes and no. It says, not like in Civ 4 per se. For Civ 5, we choose instead to have the various systems in the game create events based on the world state rather than anything purely random. City-state system is the best example of this, but there are also events related to unhappiness, espionage, and the World Congress. However, they did put a simple random event system in the Civil War scenario, so any modders who wanted to add their own random events can see one method of that.
Oh, this doesn't bother me at all. That sounds like an actual attempt at implementing events correctly instead of the garbage they gave us in Civ 4.
Like you're trying to play for a cult or victory. Here's the quest to get better swords.
No, like the early game altering stuff that severely helped or hindered you, regardless of your strategy. Like it sounds like this, you actually make choices that will lead to events occurring or mitigate the impact of the events ahead of time with some semblance of strategy rather than, oh, by the way, you lost 3 buildings.
Oh, yes.
Or, okay. Oh, by the way, you have to declare war into this defensive pact.
Yeah.
Speaking of losing things, that might segue well into the next question and answer.
What level of discontent do cities start flipping to a rival civ? When your happiness gets down to negative 20, then your cities will start abandoning your empire.
Yeah,
I would say that's impossible, but actually...
it's possible. It's not just possible, it's achievable.
This thing about when they say they will start abandoning your empire, I feel like that answer was an answer, but they're kind of more questions. Like, what does start actually mean? What does that look like? Is that like instantly minus 20 by... Or is there a period of time where there's, say, an unrest and you can't do anything? You know, like you first try to go to annex a city after you captured it and it's in resistance. Do we get units appearing, like rebels appearing, like in previous Civ titles? Do we get a combination of the two? What does that mean? Guess we'll have to see what that looks like in practice.
Sure.
Next.
Yeah, those contentedness levels appear to reflect empire-wide discontent, and how is the city to be flipped chosen? Well, if your people are this unhappy, they're going to have made up their minds they have a preferred ideology they'd like to switch to. So, like, maybe your next-door neighbors have something in their religion they like better?
Well, ideology-wise. So, if you're autocracy and your neighbor is freedom, and your people, say, like freedom, then that's what they prefer.
And I gather from the next part of from the other part of the answer, we have cultural pressure that's, I guess, going to work sort of like religious pressure does now.
Well, maybe you should read out the rest of the answer.
Sassy!
Let's die.
You're not doing it right.
It doesn't really say that much. It just says they look at all of the cities to see how close they are to the capital cities of the civs following that ideology and how much pressure receiving from each of those civs' cultures.
Say two of your neighbors are in the freedom ideology and your people prefer freedom and they're going to flip. They'll look at the distance to the capital cities of those two civs. So maybe the capital city of one civ just happens to be on the other continent versus the one right next to you on your continent. They're more likely to flip to somebody close than they are to somebody who's far away.
I just wish this happiness stuff actually mattered to the AI at all. The way its bonuses are in most of the difficulties, it really doesn't care about unhappiness that much from what I've seen. Maybe that's skewed because I've only played on the higher difficulties, but...
Yeah, you can look at my achievements. And I'll just say that. You can look at my current achievements.
Something about World Wonder exclusivity?
Yes.
Although I think that was kind of alluded to before in some other reports, but now we get it straight from the horse's mouth.
Each ideology system is going to have a wonder that can be built associated with it. And once that wonder is built, then no other civ with that ideology can build the wonder. There's also one wonder tied to each of the non-ideology social policy trees, such as Big Ben being unlocked by commerce. I like that addition because now there's so many wonders in the game, it spreads them out a little better.
Yeah, you don't have that one wonder spammer AI. Just
AI Lord Parking.
Yeah.
How that's going to work out in practice, because I think they're also making the piety and rationalism trees no longer exclusive.
That's true.
So there's not really as much of a restriction on only being able to have one social policy tree instead of the others. This actually gives an incentive to just adopt every policy tree instead of actually going to complete it, because that gives you the ability to build all those wonders.
Well, I think it's a bit of a balance, right? Because if you choose, I'm going to unlock this social policy tree just in order to be able to build that wonder, you're gambling on A, am I actually going to be able to build this wonder? Because you could check what other civilizations you already have contact with, and has anyone already adopted this social policy? What's the likelihood that they might be constructing it? But then the trade-off is, of course, perhaps you didn't get to go down farther the social policy tree you otherwise would have gone down, which would get you closer towards finishing the policy tree, which would also give you a benefit. And that would give you a benefit that would be absolute, in the sense of, you get to the end of that social policy tree, you get that, as opposed to, I'm going to adopt the social policy tree on the possibility that I'm going to be able to build that wonder. And even if I do build that wonder, is that really more beneficial for me to do that as opposed to continuing down, say, another social policy that you'd be going otherwise?
Oh, yeah. I'm not saying that adopting a new policy is going to be better than finishing an older one. I'm just saying it actually makes picking and choosing from different policy trees a little bit more of a viable strategy. Because right now, not finishing a tree is kind of crap.
Yeah, well, it depends on which tree, but yes. No, it will definitely make the cherry picking a little bit more useful in that respect. And a lot of the openers do have some benefit to them, so it's not like that it's horrible. But not finishing a social policy tree is actually bad for you, because the faith buying of the great people tied to social policy trees has been moved to the finisher. So while you can cherry pick to get all the wonders, you can't cherry pick to get the faith buying of great people anymore.
Yeah, and as the game progresses, you might like to have something viable, if not something at all, to actually spend your still accumulating faith on.
That too. Yeah.
The other thing that I'm kind of a little bit questionable about is whether or not this will actually succeed in spreading out the wonders, because unlocking the social policy trees is still tied to progress on the tech tree, which is also what gives you early access to wonders. So if you're powering through the tech tree, you're still getting early access to the opportunity to build these wonders regardless.
There's only so many social policies that you can take, and there's only so much culture in the game to be able to be spent. So it's of no use to a player nor an AI to cherry pick your way through every single social policy tree just for the wonders. You're going to be worse off than somebody who just, say, finishes tradition, liberty, or honor, and then finishes something else and then goes into ideologies for the same number of policies. They'll be doing way better than you will. So it will spread it out. And even the AI is not going to cherry pick everything, because it's just bad play.
I agree. But as I was saying, I'm just not entirely confident that that's going to have the desired effect.
It will have an effect. It just might not necessarily always spread everything out, but it's going to spread enough of it out. Not to mention that each ideology has a wonder. So you can only get one, because you can only have one ideology.
And as for the last question in the Q&A, I think there's one sentence that reveals new information, at least certain that I've come across, which is regarding any changes to the espionage system. And that new point being diplomats can't be targeted by other spies. And then in brackets, diplomatic immunity. So, so no notification. Oh, your diplomat got killed, which, you know, might have otherwise sparked an international incident.
So your diplomats are going to be getting a bunch of parking tickets and ignoring them like in real life?
Yeah.
Hey, there's realism in gameplay. Who knew?
Woo! I'd also really like to see city-states start to act a little bit more autonomously. Like, I'd actually like to see city-states declare war on each other when they don't like each other instead of just sitting around and waiting for you to do something about it. I like the game to, you know, have a little bit more of a natural feel. Like, sometimes I get annoyed when I find that I'm just playing a game and not managing an empire. Yeah, I mean, it's a personal preference, but I'd like to see that.
And apparently in Brave New World, you'll be able to play as a city-state.
Jason, I thought you were going to do a segue to the next topic. It's like, speaking of city-states and the city-state of Los Angeles recently.
Yeah. I was wondering if we were going to transition to city-states through city-states. That's weird. Is LA a city-state? Well, it's big enough. Sort of. What was in LA?
Yeah, so someone actually got to go to the city-state of Los Angeles. Yeah. Someone on this panel. What do you know?
Mackie, did you go to E3?
No.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't Mackie. Who else?
I didn't go to E3. Phil, did you go to E3?
I did not go to E3.
Jason, did you go to E3?
No, I did not.
Imagine, did you go to E3?
I don't know what you're talking about. Yes, I went to E3.
LOL.
Okay, so imagine us talking. Mackie, Phil, Jason, and I will lay out on the floor. On our stomachs, we got our hands as a bridge and our chin sitting on the bridge of our hands and our eyes wide open and blick.
Tell us more about the mystical land of E3.
Tell us the story of E3, Mr. Madgen.
Oh, the mystical land of E3.
Were there dragons?
Yes, there was, actually.
Were there ages?
There was dragons. Actually, I think there was at least two games with dragons in it.
And what'd you bring us?
I bring you. I think the two most topical points is I did get into get my hands on Total War Rome 2. We actually got to play some of that. Definitely the battle stuff is all still basically all the same and good. There's different battle actions. There is the fact that the battles are a little bit bigger than they used to be. The other one, of course, is Command & Conquer. Real-time strategy on that one. And they're back to proper Command & Conquer style. None of that whatever happened in 4. But it is a brand new developer, though. Victory Studios is their name. They're doing it. And again, I got hands-on on that. That was actually pretty fun.
Perhaps last but not least in your report, you talked about hands-on. There was also a face-on, as in yours in front of a camera.
Yeah. So we also played Touch Tag with Kate for a couple days. And we eventually did meet up. And she slapped me in front of a camera.
Yes, this is Kate Distler, the 2K community manager.
Yeah, about the community and how the community has been really great for the Civ franchise. We did talk a little bit about Brave New World. We'll see what the PR people chop out of that, because neither of us knew exactly how far we could go with it. If they ever release it, then yes, you can see that interview somewhere on the 2K community channel.
If they do release it, there'll be a lot of, am I watching a video of an awkward date? Oh, no, wait, this is Madgen and Kate talking to each other. Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was slightly
awkward. Is there something going on there that we don't know about?
No. It was slightly awkward because I didn't actually know that she was going to interview me. I figured that we'd just talk about stuff, say hi, but no, she'd just like, hey, how you doing? All right, here's a camera. Let's go.
So you didn't know it wasn't a date until she pulled out the camera.
Yeah.
Sounds like some sort of odd letter to the editor starts, you know? I can't believe this happened to me, but...
Maybe she just likes to record all the conversations she has in her day-to-day life, and it's just for her private collection, imagine. I mean, you know, that's entirely plausible.
I think that's scarier.
That's probably a little weirder, yeah.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
All right, well, I think that takes us to the end. It's probably a good thing because Jason's power keeps dropping, so it's probably a sign.
Yep, sounds that way. All right, well, for Dan Q, Mad Jin, Makalua, the Mian team, and myself, Mega Bears fan, this is Polycast signing out. Hope to catch you again later.
But where's our stuff?
Gotta get it out there before my power goes out again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's not good.
Record date June 15th, 2013. Revision 3 clips, copyright Discovery Communications. Civilization 4 and 5 sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.